What's up, everyone? This is Cece. Do you know something I'm always looking for when I review the slush pile? Strong interiority. Well-written interiority shows what your protagonist is thinking about in a way that is realistic and interesting. It propels the story forward instead of holding it back. But it doesn't stop there. A strong writer will leverage interiority into a superpower, into something I call psychological acuity. Think about it this way. Plot is what happens. Interiority is how your protagonist processes what happens. And psychological acuity is why it matters. It gives a book depth and meaning and staying power. All breakout books have psychological acuity. You have been asking me to teach a course about psychological acuity for years, years. Well, it's finally here. Why did it take me so long? Because my courses take years to build. They're dense, they're thorough, and they're filled with examples and specific techniques. So this 5-day course begins on March 2nd. We'll have an optional interactive component. Students are invited to submit excerpts from their work for a chance to have them critiqued live during a class. If you're ready to take your writing to the next level, join me for Writing Interiority and Psychological Acuity. Don't worry if you can't attend live. The sessions will be recorded. And for more information, check out my bio on Instagram or the podcast website. I'm looking forward to seeing you there.
There and welcome to our show, the shit no one tells you about writing. I'm best-selling author Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Cece Lira of Wendy Sherman Associates and Carly Waters of PS Literary. Hi everyone. Today's guest is the author of The Truth is in the Detours. She drafted her first novel in third grade in a spiral notebook, a story about a golden retriever and the stray dog who loved her. Now she writes novels about strong, messy women trying to find their way in the world. When not writing or reading, she can be found enjoying California's beaches, redwoods, and trails with her husband, kids, and disobedient dog. It's my pleasure to welcome Mara Williams. Mara, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm so excited to have you here because what I am loving this year is that I am getting to celebrate people who were on Books with Hooks, people who were at our deep dives, people who've done our beta reader matchups, which is incredible to celebrate all of you. And we're going to get to that part shortly. For now, I'm holding up the cover of the book we're discussing today, The Epicenter of Forever. Beautiful cover. For those of you who aren't watching on YouTube, go and take a look. And then I'm just going to read the flap copy before we dive in from there. Eden Hawthorne spent idyllic childhood summers in Grand Trees, a mountain town perched along a restless earthquake fault in the heart of California's fire country. But her family and future were shattered there, and she vowed never to return until news of her estranged mother's illness forces her back 20 years later. Still reeling from her recent divorce, Eden has to confront her mom's found family, including single father Caleb Connell, who blames Eden for the seismic rift that drove her away. But as they move beyond a battle of wills, Eden and Caleb discover shared wounds and intertwined histories and succumb to an attraction that feels fated. When her mother's condition worsens, Eden faces an impossible choice between the man she's falling for and the mother she's just beginning to forgive. And with time running out, Eden fears her decision will doom her to relive the aftershocks of past heartbreak. Dun, dun, dun. So, Mara, I'm going to ask you to share some of those first few pages for our listeners to get a sense of how you really open with an opening that's going to grab people's attention. Before that, can you discuss a bit your experience of being on Books with Hooks and the deep dives and the beta reader matchups? Because I love seeing in your acknowledgements so many names that I recognize.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been writing a really long time, and I was one of those writers that I needed to prove I could do it. I could finish a novel before I really dove into the ins and outs of how publishing worked. And so I'd written a couple of novels really before I was like, okay, now how do you get this published? I wanted to feel ready and like I had a novel that was publishable. And so I believe I found the podcast first, maybe by happenstance, maybe online, maybe it was in the old days of Twitter, I think, when we're all still on there, and kind of obsessively listened to try to get the feel of query letters and the publishing process and all of that. And I heard about the beta reading matchup group and I thought that's perfect. And so I started, I had a group of five authors and we actually met for about a year and a half every single month. We gave each other about 50 pages or so, 10,000 or so words every month. And we got into a really nice rhythm. And this was with actually my debut novel that I started with. And then I did the deep dive actually twice. I did a weekend one, which was really incredible. And then I did the longer one. I believe it was in 2023, maybe. And afterwards, there was a writer, Lorene, who decided, I want to get all the romance writers together. And so she got our email addresses, organized us. We developed a WhatsApp group and we started to meet monthly, less to read pages and more just to be a support for each other and to, where are you in the process? What's happening? What's going on? And from that group, four of us got agents within maybe weeks or months of each other. It was really just like a miraculous, amazing. And I'd been in the query trenches for 2.5, 3 years. And so it just felt like this really faded sort of, I found my people in the writing world. And the four of us went on a sub together. Two of us got deals pretty quickly and kind of the rest is history. So I think the classes and the partnership and the writers I met was so pivotal to this process. Somewhere in that mix, I also submitted what would become my debut to Books with Hooks. And that was probably in February 2023 or so. And by that point, I'd sort of been in the middle of querying that. So I'll pause there. But all of that was just incredibly helpful. And I think the biggest thing was developing a community. I wouldn't have survived through the ups and downs in the roller coaster. And it's really hard to establish community, I think, before you're published. I have, you know, lots of writer friends now that I've been published a while and, you know, in other circles. But my, you know, my core people that I met through Deep Dive have really been amazing.
I'm so happy to hear that. I love hearing about the community that our community builds with each other because it is so important. And in Toronto, we have something called TAWA, which is the Toronto Area Women Authors. And we meet up every 2 to 3 months. It's run by someone incredible called Lydia Laceby. And for the rest of you out there, there's nothing stopping you from starting the same things in your, you know, your cities, your areas, because it is wonderful to have WhatsApp groups and stuff. But honestly, getting together with people, real people, once every 3 months and sharing everything that's happening and, you know, leads on certain agents or just to commiserate is really, really empowering. So I would recommend that those of you out there who like taking the reins, this is something you might want to do. But also, besides that, Mara, your journey to publication has been such a fascinating one. So can you take us through that? Because it's really unusual and interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the word fascinating at the time. It was probably had some other words to describe it.
Other F words.
Yeah, probably. But I think it was in 2018, I think, when I was really like, okay, I'm going to finish a book this time. I just decided I'm going to finish it. I have so many, like a collection of unfinished manuscripts in the drawer that I just thought weren't perfect, so I wouldn't finish them. I'm like, I'm going to finish it no matter what. So I finished my first, knew it wasn't ready, knew it wasn't quite right, wrote another one. And that's when I started querying, was on book two. And I kind of was tentative about it. I think I sent out like 30 queries total. And then I'm like, okay, it's not good enough. Wrote another one. By the time I got to my fifth novel, I really thought like, this is the one. I felt confident in it. I felt like it was, you know, marketable. I had the hook and the writing obviously had been elevated now that it was my fifth one. And so I really like took querying seriously. By this point, this is when, you know, I'd taken a bunch of deep dive workshops, taken a bunch of classes, developed some friends, had a lot of feedback on the novel. And so I queried it widely. And I will say, Books with Hooks told me to take out my prologue. It broke my heart. I took out my prologue. And I'm still a big fierce advocate for prologues when they're necessary. So I'll put that out there. But in that one, I took out the prologue. And I had a ton of full requests. So I thought, okay, this is going to be the one. But ultimately, I didn't land an agent with that book. And I was pretty devastated. I think I took the others in stride. But you know, when you have a feeling like a gut, like I just think this is the book. I think this is my debut. But I put it in the drawer and I still had some full requests out. But you know, unfortunately, sometimes people don't like reply to full requests and you kind of get ghosted. And so I wasn't going to wait another, you know, 6 months to a year. So I'd written another book. By this point, it was my sixth book. Sent it out, and very quickly I got an offer on that sixth book. And then I got another offer. And so I was debating between them, chose, you know, my now agent, who's amazing. And when we went out on sub with that book, we got some initial interest. But I think a lot of the feedback that I've gotten throughout the course of my writing is, I like your voice. I don't know what genre is. I can't sell it. And I always think I'm writing romance. Like I feel like I'm writing romance. It's a central love story. There's a happily ever after. But I think my lens is always, there's a lot of other sort of emotional wounds and some subplots in there, which I see a lot in romance. But for whatever reason, a lot of people were like, we're not sure if it's women's fiction or book club or romance. And so when we sent out that book on sub, my editor said, I really love this. Again, love her voice. Not sure what genre it is, but I see on her website, she has a backlog of books. Can you send me another one so I can figure out where I can place her? Because my editor happened to sort of acquire for women's fiction and romance. And so we sent her another book, which was my book 5, the one I'd queried widely. And they ended up acquiring that one. So the one that I thought was my debut the whole time, it's The Truth Is in the Detours, the one that was on Books with Hooks that I started with my beta reading matchup group that I just really polished and to the point where if I'd done any more, I would have messed it up. And so they acquired that one and that became my debut. And I got a 2-book deal. So The Epicenter of Forever is my second book in that, which was, I'd already finished again by the time I got the deal. It was my 7th book. And the 6th book is still in the drawer. Maybe it'll come back out another time.
Wow. All these resurrected books. I absolutely love it. And this was going to be my question on Epicenter of Forever. In terms of genre, I was sitting going, you know, I'm not someone who needs to pin down genre because Lord knows my genres are all over the place. But I was like, is this women's fiction with a love story? It feels like that to me. It doesn't feel like centrally a romance. So what did you guys decide when it came to the genre?
So ultimately, we sold under women's fiction. And I think my book 3 is definitely more women's fiction than romance. But again, there's always like that love story that's really, really prominent. And so it does blur the lines. It's kind of for those who really love a romance with maybe a side of family dysfunction and trauma and a little bit of, you know, a side adventure.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is, it is frustrating that it's expected to kind of be one or the other because romance doesn't happen in a vacuum, you know? Your life is happening. Things are happening. People are dying. There's people you aren't speaking to. There's a pandemic, whatever's happening in the world. And then you happen to meet someone. And that is just a part of what else is going on in your life. So for me, I find it frustrating that there has to be, it's just romance or it's women's fiction, etc.
Yeah. And I think that's the lens I bring to it. Like I'm an avid romance reader. I read a lot of women's fiction. I read broadly. But I think the books I always gravitated to as a reader for all time is I liked these books with, you know, a lot of plot where there was a love story that I could really attach on to and fall in love with. And also, you're right, I think in real life, when I think about telling a love story that feels relatable to me, it's about all the other stuff that's going on. I think we can all attest that there's no relationship that happens in a vacuum without it being influenced by family, by career, by, you know, tragedy, by trauma, by, you know, all of these other things that make us who we are. And so that's the lens I bring to it. And I do consider myself a romance author, but I think I am like sitting really on the edge based on sort of really strict genre conventions.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes it's a good thing. It means you can appeal to a wider audience. Okay. Will you read us the excerpt from chapter 1 for us, please?
Sure. I must have fallen for a billion little lies to wind up here, unexpectedly face to face with my ex and his pregnant girlfriend, barely a week after our divorce. As my failed marriage flashes before my eyes, I tally every deceit and decide the cruelest one was his bullshit reason for leaving. We only hit one note, he said with a single suitcase in hand. Of course, I didn't know he was lying then, even though the truth should have been obvious. Cheating, after all, is part of my origin story. Eden, wow, Jeff says in the polite tone reserved for acquaintances. What a surprise. It's nice to see you. I have no idea how I feel about seeing him because I can't look away from the woman holding his hand. I'm disappointed in myself that my first thought is a petty one. She's pretty, but not beautiful. She has mousy brown hair that frizzes at her temples, flat blue eyes framed by blunt lashes and overplucked brows. I'm not sure I'd notice her if she weren't flaunting the evidence of Jeff's betrayal with a full abdomen that does the math for me. My second thought is a devastating one. I bet this new girlfriend, round with the baby Jeff refused to give me, must play him a motherfucking symphony. You too, I accept Jeff's hug. I don't think to hold my breath, forgetting scent memories the most stubborn. I bought him this Tom Ford cologne on the last anniversary we celebrated together. Memories of that day invade like an occupying force. Baker Beach at dusk, takeout coffee cooling in my palms, fog so thick we couldn't see the bridge. Eden, this is Nadia. Nadia, this is Eden. Nadia, Nadia, Nadia. The name is familiar but less potent than the cologne. It's nice to meet you, Eden. Nadia extends her hand. It's disorienting to live in two worlds at once. Internally, I'm devastated by the delayed realization that my marriage ended in infidelity. I'm furious that Jeff fed me a half-truth drenched in a sad metaphor and I fell for it. But externally, I'm politely shaking the hand of the woman he must have been sleeping with while I did his laundry and bought his mom's birthday present. Worst of all, my irrational composure validates Jeff's frequent complaint that I'm incapable of passionate emotions. And maybe he's right. I should be yelling, screaming, crying. Instead, I'm undergoing a system reboot. Cassie emerges from the restroom and steps into the cramped cafe lobby. Her gaze darts from me to Jeff to Nadia, drawing immediate conclusions. Jeffrey, what a surprise, she says. Who's this? Jeff's face goes pale. Somehow, I didn't suspect he was a cheating scumbag, but I can tell he's scared shitless by the look on Cassie's face.
As you know, we have booked our summer adventure. We're off to Germany and Austria for the kids' summer break. I've been to Frankfurt for the book fair, but nowhere else in Germany. I've been to Zurich, but nowhere else in that region, so I am pumped. I can't wait to carry the kids up the mountains while we hike. Kidding. But what they often excel at is language. My kids are getting really strong French skills, but I can't wait for us to learn some German before we go so we feel less like tourists and more like locals, connected to the country and confident when we are out and about. Rosetta Stone has been the trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you truly pick up your new language naturally. No memorizing random vocabulary lists, no feeling lost. Since we're traveling soon, we know that Rosetta Stone always has our back. They are the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, Japanese, and more. It is a go-to tool for real language growth. You can learn anytime, anywhere. Rosetta Stone fits your lifestyle with flexible on-the-go learning. You can access lessons from your desktop or mobile app, whether you have 5 minutes or an hour. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. Shit About Writing listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That is unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Go to rosettastone.com/today.
Cassie extends her hand to Nadia and Nadia takes it, giving a good impression of nonchalance if her left eye weren't twitching. I'm Cassie, Eden's best friend. At their wedding, I gave a speech about what a nice guy Jeff was, but I guess even smart women get duped by assholes. Cassie, Jeff warns. Cassie cocks her head toward Nadia's pregnant belly. Yours? Jeff looks at me before pursing his lips and nodding. Congratulations. When are you due? Cassie asks Nadia, the hard edge of her voice smooth to velvet. Nadia hesitates, looks at Jeff, whose gaze is ensnared with mine, and stutters, Friday.
Wow. Talk about an opening that grabs your reader's attention. I was squirming while I was reading those pages. I felt so awkward, but I loved Cassie because I'd be the Cassie in this scenario.
Yes.
And the juxtaposition between them was so brilliant. Was this always your opening or was it an opening you had to work on?
Actually, it was always my opening. I think I work on opening pages so much and so deliberately each time, and sometimes it's what I revise the most. But for whatever reason, I think that opening sentence was the opening sentence, the opening scene. There was a lot of finessing, but I didn't go back and forth of maybe I should start here, maybe I should start here, like I do with a lot of my novels. It is the hardest part. I think, but for whatever reason, sometimes it's easier than others. And I just saw it, I felt it. And you're right, the juxtaposition. I think Eden's arc is really to get more in touch with her feelings and be able to say what she means when she means it. And having Cassie as a best friend who always says what she means was a juxtaposition I thought was really important as I wrote it.
It was a great example of using a secondary character so effectively, because the fact that Jeff is more terrified of Cassie than what he is of his ex-wife, who didn't know that he had a baby with somebody else, says a lot, you know. And then their conversation that follows gives us kind of hints of backstory, etc., but not so much that we drag back into it. So a really, really great example of effectively leveraging that secondary character. Okay, another thing to write that is difficult is writing secrets that one character knows that another doesn't, right? To create this kind of tension where clearly there's a curiosity seed, something has happened, but we don't know what's happened. And so we keep turning the pages to find out what happened, but the other character doesn't know this. So for you, how do you know how to calibrate this kind of thing? How far do you push it? And is this where your beta readers come in handy, being able to say, okay, this needs to be revealed now. I'm feeling manipulated. This is always something that some writers do instinctually and others are like, no, I need people to help me. So how did you go about that?
That is such a good question. I think it depends on the book. So this one, I felt it was a little bit more natural. I knew what the secret was. I knew why she was withholding it, but you know, there were little, I didn't want it to feel like she was intentionally withholding it. So I think sometimes when you have a trauma in your backstory, I feel kind of strongly about this, that you don't think like, oh, that time that XYZ happened, I was really sad. You sort of, it's in your body language. It's in how you approach certain things. It's in how you really adapt to the environment around you. You may have a feeling like you see something that reminds you of it and you look away. And so there are a lot of those hints throughout where, you know, an astute reader can figure out at least, you know, 80, 90%. And I want my reader to have a sense so it doesn't come absolutely out of the blue. They're like, oh, I didn't see that coming, or I didn't see anything coming, or I thought it was this, but actually, you know, it's something entirely different. Like, you don't want to jump the shark at the three-quarter way. But what I do want to do is leave enough hints that the reader can sort of figure out 80% of it, but then be surprised by a little bit. But also, if you read it again, I want the reader to go, oh, I could have pieced it together. I see the hints there and there and there and there. They weren't intentionally trying to deceive me. The character was just going about their world. In their mind, they know what's happened. They're not going to tell the reader, kind of like backstory, like here, this traumatic moment happened in this explicit way. So usually with reveals, you know, for this one particularly, it's in dialogue. And so I do feel pretty strongly about it that it has to be a balance between giving the reader enough of a hint so they don't feel gaslit, I think, by the book, but also not so much that there aren't some, you know, a gasp or a surprise or like, wow, I didn't know it was that bad or whatever the surprise is. For this book in particular, I think because I knew what happened, because I knew the players that would know what happened, didn't know what happened, why they wouldn't know, it felt somewhat natural. But it's a funny question you ask because I'm currently writing another one where there's, you know, a surprise as well. And I just got beta reader feedback that's conflicting, like, oh, I want to know more here. And some others were like, nope, it was perfect. I knew, I kind of figured it out, but not entirely. Don't change it. And so I think one of the most important things about learning to write is I was always really good about taking feedback. I took a lot of feedback, but what I've had to learn is like, sometimes you don't take feedback because you can't please every reader. And you have to write the book for the people who need it. You have to find your audience. And sometimes you're getting feedback from people who wouldn't be your audience anyway. So it's a really difficult balance to strike, I think. But for whatever reason in this book, it was a little bit easier than some others I've written.
Yeah, two really interesting things you've said there. One, like, trauma becomes a part of our body. It becomes so ingrained in our identity. Most of the times we are making so many decisions in our lives, the things we avoid, the people we're attracted to, the people we don't want to be around, the situations we put ourselves in are linked to that trauma and we're not even consciously aware of it. So I love that, making all of that. It's almost like the misbelief or the character's wound so integral to who they are that when we go back, we're like, of course, that person would do these kinds of things based on what happened to them. I really like that. Do you plot everything out? Because what I will do, I know you said that you knew what was happening, but for me, as I write and I figure out what's happening, then I reverse engineer and then I can come and put those curiosity seeds in so that it felt like it was going to be that way all the time, even though I only figured it out on like page 120.
Yeah, I am not a plotter. I think there's, you know, a spectrum. Sometimes I just get started, and I have had manuscripts that I pantsed so much that I couldn't figure out what happened next and I had to put them aside. But I am a pantser. I don't force myself to sit down and plot, I guess is a better way of doing it. I do by the 10% mark want to figure out, okay, what is the explosion going to be in the third act? Not a literal explosion sometimes, but most of the time, some emotional explosion. I want to see where that conflict is, because if I don't have that, it's my favorite part to write. I love when everything goes south and it's all messed up and you have to figure out how to put it back together. But also I want to make sure there's enough gas in the tank of the novel to get me there. So by about 10, 20%, I feel like I need to know what that is. And if I know what that is, I can take a lot of detours and not know where I'm going in the next chapter, as long as I know where the almost final destination is. And from there, if I can get to that point, the endings are incredibly easy. I feel like I'm just rolling downhill. Like I know how to close it out most of the time. Sometimes I really screw everything up. So in this case, I think I knew actually the idea for the book was the third act. So I knew what had happened and was really driving the book to that point, but I'm not a plotter and let myself sort of discover. And I want to be surprised and I want to go, oh gosh, I did not see that coming. I didn't know they were going to do that. That's what keeps the writing part interesting for me, is that creative process.
Yeah, same. And I love that long dark night of the soul for the character when all seems lost and completely bleakness, and then they have to rebuild themselves up and come back. Something you were saying as well about the beta readers, and that's so important, because as important as it is to get people reading your work and critiquing your work, I was the same as you in the beginning, because I'm a chronic people pleaser.
Yes.
Any bit of feedback I would get, I would change it. And eventually, yep, it lost all sense of the vision I had for it. So it is so important to look for consistencies, especially like if you have three or four beta readers, if one says, I wanted more, the other three say, no, it's calibrated perfectly, then you go with the majority. And sometimes you'll have the majority say something and you still feel strongly about it. And then in that instance, instead of saying, I'm going to ignore everyone, you say, why didn't it land for you? How Yes. can I improve it so that it does land for you? Because I feel quite strongly about keeping this in. And that comes with time and experience with beta readers, right?
Absolutely. I think it's always a delicate dance. Like I was having a conversation literally last night as I received some beta reader feedback. And there's a part I feel really strongly about, but I'm like, there's a truth in their feedback. I have to figure out how to address it, even if it's not based on their recommendation. They say, this isn't working. Here's what I think you need to do. You take the, here's what's not working, but you don't have to take, here's what you need to do to fix it. Right. You can fix it in a different way that still aligns to your vision. And it's really, it takes a lot of trial and error and a lot of practice and a lot of confidence. I think part of finding your voice is finding that, like figuring out what feedback to take and what feedback not to take.
And something I want to ask you there is, because I know every time I do a beta reader matchup, I know that 90% of the people just want their work critiqued. They want their work critiqued and they want to go with that. But I found that I became a much better writer when I started critiquing other people's work, not by just having my work critiqued, because once you are able to say to somebody, this works for this reason, or this isn't working for this reason, that's something that you can apply to your own work.
Oh, for sure. I think I do a lot of beta reading and I have, you know, a wide variety of critique partners. And I think sometimes it's just providing a little bit of feedback. I've also gotten better at that, at realizing, okay, this isn't what I would do, and sort of reverse engineering that, making sure that I'm not trying to give them advice based on how I would write it, but how to make their vision better. And it's a skill honed over time. And I think I've gotten a lot better at it. And I'm still at a point where I always say yes, which is probably getting me into a little bit of trouble. But I think looking at other people's work, especially in different phases, I think when we're just starting out, all we see are the finished books and the finished products that have been edited and polished. But seeing that process for other people and seeing how other people work helps you figure out how you can work. You know, I've now seen quite a few books from their first draft to publication, and realizing how much change and shifting and evolution goes in is incredibly helpful. And how to be helpful, how to see what's not working and how to make a recommendation of how they might fix it has really helped me fix things in my own manuscripts for sure.
Yeah, I really, really agree with that. Well, we passed our time, everyone. I'm holding up the book cover, The Epicenter of Forever, Mara Williams. We are linking to this on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you buy the book there, you support the podcast and an independent bookstore at the same time. Mara, love the book and love chatting with you and wishing you all the best with it.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me. I had a great time.
CC Lira is a literary agent at Wendy Sherman Associates. If you'd like to query CC, please refer to the submission guidelines at www.wsherman.com. Carly Waters is a literary agent at PS Literary Agency, but her work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly on this podcast are solely that of her as a podcast co-host and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency.
What's up, everyone? This is Cece. Do you know something I'm always looking for when I review the slush pile? Strong interiority. Well-written interiority shows what your protagonist is thinking about in a way that is realistic and interesting. It propels the story forward instead of holding it back. But it doesn't stop there. A strong writer will leverage interiority into a superpower, into something I call psychological acuity. Think about it this way. Plot is what happens. Interiority is how your protagonist processes what happens. And psychological acuity is why it matters. It gives a book depth and meaning and staying power. All breakout books have psychological acuity. You have been asking me to teach a course about psychological acuity for years, years. Well, it's finally here. Why did it take me so long? Because my courses take years to build. They're dense, they're thorough, and they're filled with examples and specific techniques. So this 5-day course begins on March 2nd. We'll have an optional interactive component. Students are invited to submit excerpts from their work for a chance to have them critiqued live during a class. If you're ready to take your writing to the next level, join me for Writing Interiority and Psychological Acuity. Don't worry if you can't attend live. The sessions will be recorded. And for more information, check out my bio on Instagram or the podcast website. I'm looking forward to seeing you there.